This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, beginning an oral history interview with Colonel Herbert Chandler, U.S. Army retired. Today's date is what is today's date, sir? Do you know?
I think it's the 28th.
I believe you're right. I'm sorry. I normally have this ready. It's the 28th, yes, of September 2004, and I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and the colonel is speaking to me by telephone from Virginia. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I want to thank you so much for participating in the Oral History Project here. I'd like to begin by asking you some general biographical data. Would you tell us where you were born, sir, and when?
I was born in Asheville, North Carolina, on the 2nd of January, 1928.
You were a New Year's baby.
Yeah. It's been downhill ever since.
Is that right?
No.
Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah.
Sir, if you would, tell me, were there other children in the family besides
yourself? Oh, sure. I was the fifth of six.
Okay. And,
The five boys and one girl.
Let me know a little bit, if you can, about your mother. First of all, what was her name?
Sarah Chandler. Sarah Salem Chandler. Salem was her maiden name.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about her, sir. Where was she from?
Well, she was born in Metau, M-E-T-A-U, Latvia, which at that time was occupied by Russia,
mm-hmm.
I suppose. She came to the United States in 1909. Her brother was a pharmacist in Chicago, and he brought her over. And she settled down in Chicago. He was a pharmacist. She was a housewife in Chicago. I guess his whole family was there.
His whole family was already there?
Yeah.
Did she live with them then?
As far as I know, sure.
Mm-hmm. Did she work outside the home?
No, she didn't.
Okay. And how did she meet your father?
Well, my father met her in Latvia. He came over after she did,
mm-hmm.
sometime in 1909, and hitchhiked his way out to Chicago since he knew no English and had no money. And he met her in Chicago. He was going after her, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
He knew her from the old country, and they were married in 1911. I got a picture of their wedding here, August the 11th, 1911.
And he had his cap set for her, it sounds like.
That's right. He came over to find her, or knew where she was. And
okay. Were their families connected somehow?
No.
In Europe?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Except they came from the same hometown.
Yeah.
Metau, which is now called Jelgava, J-E-L-G-A-V-A. I visited there in about 1989, I think.
I was going to ask you, had you been there?
Oh, yeah. I I had a long talk at a NATO symposium in Rome with a young man who was said he was with the Ministry of Defense in Lithuania.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a nice letter from him saying he really enjoyed our conversation. And I wanted to continue it, and it turned out he was the Minister of Defense. And
okay.
So I got an invitation to speak at the Verunsakademie der Bundeswehr in Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was in Hamburg, my boss said, "Why don't you go to Lithuania? It's not very far." And so I went to Lithuania to talk to him, and then I called the Latvian minister in Washington, said, "Well, I'll go to Latvia as long as I'm so close."
Mm-hmm.
So I spent about 3 days in Lithuania and 3 days in Latvia, and they had me all set up to go to a tour of Jelgava with the local regional military commander and the border guard battalion commander.
Mm-hmm. And on your tours, then, you made time to visit your parents' home city.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What was your impression of it? What was going on there in 1989?
Well, not very much. It was a bustling city.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big, Duke of Courland, it was called Courland at that time, and the Duke of Courland had a big castle on the hill, which the Soviets had turned into an agricultural college.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was bound up with an agricultural college. My parents called it Courland, C-O-U-R-L-A-N-D, And that was the Duke of Courland, who was Russian, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the regional military commander didn't really know much about it. And we went to a museum there, and they had a big map of Courland, and they had an effigy of the Duke of Courland. And so I taught him a lot about it, too.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, of course, this was right, in the midst of the ferment.
Oh, yeah. It was the beginning of the ferment. We were shown where the people in Latvia and Lithuania had to start going back to church.
Really?
Uh-huh. And my guide, my show, it was mostly the old people going back to the church, mm-hmm. and they were beginning to ferment a little bit.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
They were very kind to me.
Did pretty much everyone recognize you as an American?
Not really. I guess they did. The ones I talked to, which was I had a Canadian lady who was my guide and interpreter, and then I had a driver, and I had the regional military commander and the border guard battalion commander, so there were five of us really going around this car.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going into, I bought them all dinner. We had a big luncheon, and we had borscht, and we had a pot roast, and we had drinks and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the lady, I said, only this guy have American money. How much is it? I want to pay for everybody. And she went in the corner and conferred with her husband, I guess. She came back and said, well, altogether it's $5.
Yes. Astounding.
The dollar and the Deutschmark were the items we exchanged there.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you didn't buy anything that came from outside, if you wanted French wine, it was very expensive, but just buying stuff that was produced there in Latvia, very cheap.
That's very reminiscent of my own experiences around the same time in Czechoslovakia. Same thing. Yes. Sir, going back to your own family. First of all, tell me your father's name. Let's make sure we get that.
Okay, David. David Sigmund Chandler. S I G M O N D.
Mm-hmm. What had been his trade or occupation before?
He had been the prince baker.
I'm sorry?
He was an apprentice baker.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, an apprentice baker. Did he do the same thing when he came to Chicago?
Oh, no. Since his brother-in-law was a pharmacist, he became a pharmacist.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They should have stayed together. They could have been the Johnson & Johnson of the new generation.
That's right. That's right.
They invented a liniment called Salem's Velvet Rub. And we had some of that when I was little,
uh-huh.
which was kind of a liniment where you put, like a wintergreen oil that you put on strained muscles.
Sore muscles.
So they can feel better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they invented that. But then, after my father had been in the States for about a year or two, he decided to bring his grandmother, his mother,
mm-hmm.
my grandmother, and my wife's mother, my mother's mother, over, and one of them had some kind of an eye disease or something, so he had to put up about $500,000 bond that he would be responsible for him. So he did.
Now, that would be because there were some kind of restrictions on people coming into the country who had a physical
problem?
That's
right. He had to be responsible for him and see that she had a job and she'd be taken care of and so on.
How did he manage to put up such a bond?
Well, it beats me, but they were very prosperous, apparently.
That's incredible.
And put it up just after he'd been here about a year or so, yeah.
Wow.
And then it turned out that, I don't know, one of these grandmothers had some kind of disease. It's probably tuberculosis. Because
mm-hmm.
at that time, you treated tuberculosis by going to a wholesome climate for it.
Yes, that's right.
And so my father was going to have to take my grandmother, his mother, to some place. I think it was my mother's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking to go to Montana. He said they would give you free land if you'd be a sheep herder in Montana. And the climate there was good for what she had.
Yes.
And then somebody told him that, well, the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina, were very good for that, too. And he booked in Montana, and he booked in North Carolina, and he, thank God, decided to go to North Carolina. So that's how I ended up my show in North Carolina.
Okay, and about what time, about what year do you know that did they move down
there? Oh, boy. 1911. It's about 1915 or 16, I guess. I don't really know.
They must have been some site coming into Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah, well, they only had one child at that time.
Uh-huh.
They settled down there.
Now, who was the oldest child?
Aaron was the oldest.
Now, that would be your brother, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And if you don't mind, Colonel, tell me, what happened with Aaron? What did he do as he grew up?
Well, as Aaron grew up, he had a very sheltered life. My father was in the wholesale cigar and newspaper business. He supplied all the other people around and the trains that were coming through in Nashville with the newspapers and candy bars and cigars and cigarettes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron was a privileged kid that had a cigar named after him called Chandler Jr.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he was very prosperous. And then he met a man who said he knew all about the movie theater business.
Mm-hmm.
And so they built a movie theater, which is still the largest one in Asheville, called the Plaza Theater.
Hmm.
But then it turned out that this guy didn't know anything about movies. And then the Depression hit.
Okay.
And so they lost the movie, and they lost about everything else. And my father had one piece of property remaining, and that was a grocery store, so he was in the grocery business from then on.
Okay.
And he was apparently the only one, or one of the few in Asheville, that paid all his bills and got out of the Depression that way. Because when he died, I was going to his desk, and I found a note from the local banker, Charles Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And the note said, "I've been watching you through this financial crisis. You have the heart of a lion. It's people like you who made this country great. If there's anything I can do for you, let me know."
Wow.
I wish I'd kept that.
Yeah, that's quite a testimony to have something like that from a banker.
Yeah.
Especially at that time.
At that time, sure, because he paid all his bills.
Yes.
And then he was in the grocery business.
And did he then stay in Asheville or that
area?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Stayed in Nashville, lived and died in Nashville.
Now, is the Plaza Theater building still there?
Oh, yeah.
Is it still functioning?
Yeah.
No kidding.
It's still the biggest theater in Nashville.
That's amazing.
They used to have stage shows when I was little. I don't think my father owns it anymore, but
uh-huh.
They had stage shows and vaudeville acts and so on.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember we saw Ozzy and Harriet on the stage one time. That was the only thing I remember about it.
Wow.
It had a big lobby and a big fountain in the lobby.
It sounds quite ornate.
Yeah, well, it was this big, had a big lobby.
Yeah, quite something for Asheville, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Especially at that time, wow.
Yeah.
Quite amazing. Well, let me ask a little bit more about your own childhood. Now, you came along, there was a whole group of kids ahead of you.
Yeah. I came along in 1928, uh-huh. just in time to experience the Depression.
Yeah, I was going to say, hit the Depression full force. How did your father do? You talked about the grocery store. Was that part of how he got the family through during the Depression?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Tell me your memories of that time. Anything you remember, do you remember having to skimp and sort of...
No. I remember, though, that we lived above the grocery store, big house, and the second floor of the grocery store was our house.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we always got the leftovers, and the apples and potatoes that were no good, that were beginning to
mm-hmm.
go bad. My mother would cut the bad part off, and we'd eat the rest of it. So
sure.
We got through that way, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, and I remember... Well, that's about all. I remember we had a long driveway at the side of the house, and we lived up above it, and there was a big backyard.
And is that where you kids played most of the time?
Yeah, in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big vacant lot next door to us in the rear, and it was owned by the city, and they stored all kinds of water pipes and things there, and we played in there.
That sounds ready-made.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
what kind of friends did you have growing up?
Oh, well, the best friend we had was Bobby Lewis. And his father owned another theater in town.
Mm-hmm.
And his uncle was a funeral director. He used to take us to school because he lived right around the corner. He'd drive us to school every morning, and then we would always get in the movies free on Saturday to see the serials that they had in the cowboy movies, Zorro the Great.
Mm-hmm. Which was your favorite? Do you remember?
No, I just remember Zorro.
Did you like Zorro?
Oh, yeah. They would always end each session with Zorro about to get killed, and then you'd come back the next time, and
he'd
go on for another time.
That's right. That sounded pretty good, huh?
Oh, yeah.
did you guys get into the movies for nothing?
Oh, yeah, that time.
Mm-hmm.
With Bobby Lewis, yeah.
Right. Tell me about the school that you were going to.
Well, let's see. I went to Claxton Elementary School.
Mm-hmm.
Which was quite a way out. And then I remember my parents always used to send the truck driver to pick me up and take me home and give me lunch and then take me back to school.
Now, who would do that? The
truck driver.
Okay.
Don C. Martin was his name.
And did he do odd jobs around the town, too? Or?
No. He was our truck driver.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see.
We delivered groceries.
I see. I'm with you.
Twice a day we had delivery in the north end of the town in the morning and out to the more forest in the afternoon.
And he had to work in there picking you up. And...
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
If anything, can you tell me about the school itself? What kind of a building was it?
Well, it was a white building, sort of square, three stories tall, and I guess it was a primary school.
Mm-hmm.
Asheville was, of course, segregated in that time.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So they had this regular, I don't know how they went, up to the eighth grade, I guess. And the eighth grade was at Lee H. Edwards High School. It was a very modern high school on the other side of town that they had built before the Depression when they had a lot of money. And it was a beautiful building with stone and a big football field out in the back.
Now, where did the African American children go to school?
Oh, they went to Stevens Lee High School, which was closer to our house, but was in the Negro section of town.
Mm-hmm. And did you have friends who were black? Did you know anybody who was black, or was
it completely
separate?
Oh yeah, well,
separate?
We had a maid
uh-huh.
until I was old enough to be him, who gave me baths, and I was old enough to be embarrassed by it.
Okay, uh-huh.
We had the Martin family worked for us. Gansy Martin was the truck driver,
mm-hmm.
and Fanny Martin was a clerk in the store, and her sister would come along sometime. We had a washerwoman named, what was her name? Lula. Lula was a washerwoman. She'd come every Monday and have big tubs and a
mm-hmm.
washing board and do all the washing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we had a lot of friends. My father, at his funeral, there were just as many black people as there were white people, I suppose.
When did he die?
Let's see, 1954. I was at Fort Leavenworth, at Command General Staff College, yeah, so that must have been 54,
mm-hmm.
late 54.
Mm-hmm. Under what circumstances?
Oh, he had a stroke.
Okay.
While he was in the bathroom, and he fell down and hit his head on the bathtub, so I don't know
mm-hmm.
if the stroke killed him or whether hitting his head killed him.
Mm-hmm. But you were mentioning that at his funeral, both white and black people.
Oh, yeah. Asheville was segregated, but it was a very friendly town. People, there was no desegregation movement there. Everybody seemed to be happy and content.
Mm-hmm. So there weren't the animosities that we've seen.
No animosities mm-hmm. at all, absolutely. Mm-hmm. When the Brown versus Board of Education came through,
yes.
everybody said, well, it's about time, hooray, and then went about their business.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Well, tell me a little bit more about your high school. Did all of your older brothers and sisters go there?
I don't think Aaron went there because it wasn't built then. It was built at about 28 when they had a lot of money going around.
I see, uh-huh.
So I don't think he went there, but everybody else went there.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Had a school bus pick us up and drive us down there. Drive us right past the Negro High School and to Lee Edwards, which was on the far side of town.
When you arrived there, the pattern probably had kind of been set, the Chandlers showing up there.
Yeah.
Were your older sisters and brother, had they been good students?
Well, I suppose so, yeah.
And what about you? What about you, sir?
Yeah, I was pretty good.
Uh-huh, I had a feeling.
Yeah. Let's see, my older brother went to college for 2 years, and then the Depression hit, and he dropped out of college. And then the second brother went, and the third brother went, and then there was her turn. She went to a business school, didn't go to college at all. And then my little brother, my brother and my younger brother, we both went to college.
Now, when you were in high school, did you play sports?
I was on the track team until the war came. And when the war came, World War II, and Gonzi Martin, the truck driver, got drafted, then I became the truck driver.
And did that mean you had to let go of?
Let go of everything after school. I'd rush home to take the afternoon's delivery, yeah.
Okay. Tell me about what you remember about the war being declared.
Well, I had all my brothers. Three brothers were in the war. And Aaron was in Europe and Jack was in the Pacific. And what I remember about it was that we had gasoline ration stamps. And every once in a while, the ration stamps would have to be renewed. And so they would take some of the best people out of high school who could miss a day to renew the ration stamps. And in my father's store, they had red stamps and blue stamps. The red stamps were for meat, and the blue stamps were for everything else, I guess. And I would collect these stamps as I went around. And then every month they would change the value of what you could buy with these stamps. And so I remember erasing all the cans and putting a new point on the can. And I remember we had a bank account of red and blue stamps, and we had thousands of red and blue stamps to our credit, and so it really didn't affect us very much. Our good customers, we would give them anything they wanted, take all their stamps. That was my job on the delivery.
Now, Colonel, if you don't mind, can you tell me a little bit about your brother's service? What did you find out later they had done, starting perhaps with Aaron?
Okay, with Aaron. Aaron joined the Army in 41 because he wanted to get away from the grocery store.
Okay.
And then he went to Officer Candidate School at the Schuylkill Arsenal and was commissioned in the Quartermaster Corps. And at that time, you know, my father's persistence in the Depression paid off because, you know, we'd have to get letters of recommendation. We'd go to the bank and the editor of the newspaper and all that, and they'd all say, well, we don't know you, but if you're Dave Chandler's son, you ought to go to OCS.
Yes, yes, sir.
And so he went to OCS, and then he was transferred to San Bernardino, California. He was the transportation officer for the 44th Division, and he was in charge of evacuating Japanese from the West Coast.
Really?
Yeah. And then he went overseas to Cardiff, England, where they were getting ready for the invasion. And then when the invasion started, he was transferred to Mons, Belgium, and his job was supplying Patton's Third Army with gasoline and oil. And he ended the war as a major. And he really enjoyed it and wanted to stay in, but he decided not to stay in. He was very active in the reserves from that time on.
Okay.
He ended up as lieutenant colonel in the reserves, and every time I came home from West Point, I'd have to address the local reserve meeting.
He put you to work, huh?
Yeah. And then Jack, second one, he was in the Navy. He went to Navy OCS in somewhere in New York, And then he went to a destroyer minesweeper, which has been an 04 stacker destroyer in World War One, and he was in the invasion of Casablanca. And then he came home to New York and got married, and then he went to the Pacific for 36 months and was in all the invasions there.
Was he really?
Yeah.
And what kind of craft was he on out in the Pacific?
A destroyer minesweeper.
Okay.
They go in first. And the USS Hamilton, I think it was, they go in first and sweep the mines and make paths for the other people. So he said after Iwo Jima, they were patrolling the seas and picking up airplane pilots, B-29 pilots who had crashed at sea, who got shot down. They were picking them up.
They were picking up pilots.
Yeah. At the end.
Wow.
And then Ruth, she went to, Seymour was a, lieutenant in the Navy also, but he was working at the Philadelphia Navy Yard as a technician, a laboratory guy.
Uh-huh.
And so they made him a lieutenant in the Navy, and he stayed there.
Did he stay in the Navy?
No, he stayed at the Philadelphia Navy Yard.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. I'm sorry.
They've all got out of the Navy as quick as they could.
They did,
but
huh?
Jack, he didn't like it. He was at sea the whole time. He said the Kane Mutiny was written about his destroyer. They didn't like the commander. They didn't have much fun.
Oh, no.
And
really?
They were on every invasion.
Yeah, well.
And he hadn't seen his wife in 32 months. So.
He's ready to get out of there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Settle down.
Yes,
sir. And then Ruth, my sister, went to Washington to be a secretary, and she met her future husband up there. He was in the Navy as a chief petty officer. He knew about computers. They were just beginning to think about computers, and you know, they had file cards and all that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And he was good at that.
Okay.
He should have stayed with it, but he didn't. And then there was my little brother and myself.
Now,
and we went around on Saturdays and collected newspapers and grease and whatever else they were collecting at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and gave it to the Boy Scouts.
So you were involved in doing that? Did you make bit of money?
I was in the Boy Scouts.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
No, we didn't make any money. We donated that stuff.
Now, that was those were the drives to sort of recover materials.
Yeah, recover material. Uh-huh. Scrap iron. We didn't get much of that, but we got newspapers.
Now, Colonel, can you tell me, just thinking back about this, knowing that all these members of your family, your brothers and sisters, were serving the country, thinking about that, what kind of influence did that have on you?
Well, I don't know. It made me, I saw a movie once, made me want to go to West Point.
What movie was that?
I think it was, what was the name of it? The gentleman from West Point, something like that. It was Leslie Howard was in it.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember him, you don't.
Yes, I do. I do remember him. He was a British actor, I think.
Yeah,
so.
But he was an American cadet in this movie.
Oh, okay. Well, he was a very smooth American cadet. Yeah.
He was a cadet, and the movie was about a football player at West Point who was going to have to leave because his mother didn't have any money, needed him at home.
Mm-hmm.
And Leslie Howard was very rich, and he sneaked off post once and sent her some money so this guy could play football.
Perfect.
And they caught him,
mm-hmm.
and he wouldn't admit anything until they silenced him. Nobody would talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would be lonely in his room listening to the football game that this guy was a big hero in, that he had saved. And finally, at the end, it all came out, and they all gathered around and shook his hand, and were all sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was nice.
And you thought, what's this about West Point? What's this thing?
Yeah,
West Point?
I thought they seemed to be pretty nice guys up there. And so I wanted to go there.
Now, can you tell me how it came about that you did indeed get to go there?
Well, I went to the University of Cincinnati first, and while I was there, apparently I'd spent a year there, and then apparently the next summer, someone who had been appointed to West Point had flunked the exam, and my senator was able to choose somebody else, and it was in the middle of July, and it was pretty late, and so he chose me because that's the only name he had. And I went up to West Point in June to take my sample and all that, and then it turned around in July and said, okay, you're in.
Now, what year did you start then?
47.
And did you start as a freshman?
I know. Oh, yeah, everybody does.
Okay. Regardless of the fact that you'd already been a year at college.
Well, yeah, that didn't have any influence, it made it a little easier for me.
Yes, I'm sure.
First year.
How did you happen to go to University of Cincinnati?
Well, my father had some friends there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they had a cooperative program where you could go to school for a while and then work for a while and then go to school for a while. And they'd arrange all that, and that's how I ended up there, I guess.
Oh, okay. Now, you mentioned that your senator had your name.
Yeah, I was writing him all the time.
Okay, who was it?
Senator Huey, H-O-E-Y, from North Carolina.
And you just kept writing to him?
Yeah, and I also had a representative who had been in Congress for about 25 years. And just the year I wanted to go in, he didn't get reelected.
Ouch. Who was that? Do you remember?
I don't know. Senator Zebulon Weaver, Congressman Zebulon Weaver. That's his name.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, your strategy then was to bombard the senator with letters.
Yeah.
But did you have any other, as they say now,
pull? Oh, yeah.
Do you have
I had some. One of the guys in North Carolina knew my father, a lawyer. He became assistant attorney general, and I don't know if they helped any, but I remember a big meeting we had in my house where all these guys were going to write letters. And again, you know, we don't know who Herb Chandler is, but if he's Dave Chandler's boy, he ought to go to West Point.
Okay.
And that was the attitude, so a lot of them got together, and I don't know if they used any influence or not, but they knew people in Washington.
Sure.
And might have helped.
Now, do you remember the day that you found out you were going to be called to have this opportunity?
Oh, yeah. I had to go up to West Point to take my physical.
Can you tell me about what went through you when you found out that you were going to have this chance?
I was very happy.
I'll
bet. I had to start all over again as a freshman, but I was very happy, and I got up there to West Point, and took my physical and went home, and as soon as I got home, they called me back and said, you're in, come on up here. So I didn't have much time to think about it.
What was your parents' reaction? First, your mom.
Well, she didn't like it.
Why is that?
Well, they didn't want me to be a soldier. They wanted me to be a doctor or somebody, a professional, so that when I graduated, I could hang out my shingle any place and have a job. I wouldn't have to ask anybody for a job.
Okay.
They wanted me a dentist or a doctor or something like that.
Uh-huh. Had she also had a hard time during the war with your brothers being gone?
Well, yeah, I guess she didn't like it very much, especially the one in the Pacific. He was in battles all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what about your dad?
Well, I guess he was pretty proud. They came up to see me in the plebe year, plebe Christmas, I guess, and they were very proud of my being there.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. Colonel, tell me about that first year. How did you adjust?
Well, I don't know. I had two good roommates, and you just had to get used to it. Once you got used to it, it was okay. I got used to the academics very easily, and getting hollered at. In Beast Barracks, which is what they call the summer before the academics start, I was the eighth biggest screw-up in my company.
The eighth biggest screw-up?
Well, sometimes I was seventh.
Okay.
Because they had a table in the dining hall which had three mean upperclassmen, and they had the seven biggest screw-ups as cadets. And then when one of those cadets did something good, he would get taken off, and I became the seventh, and I'd get on that table. And then another plebe would screw up, and they would put him on the table and take me off. So then I was the eighth biggest screw-up, not the seventh. So that's how I could tell where I was.
Okay, so they kept you in the pecking order pretty clearly from the beginning.
That's right.
You mentioned that you had these two roommates. Can you tell me a little bit about who they were?
Let me think back. There was one from New Hampshire. And there was one from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Check was a Czech. And his name, I remember, was Chizanacek, and they changed it to Check.
They just changed it?
Yeah, well, his parents changed
it.
So I had Jim Check, and I think his guy was named Walker from New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And Jim Check was very serious, and Walker was not very strong. I don't know what happened to him, because after that we got sent to different companies, and I had different roommates.
When you say he wasn't very strong, do you mean that physically he wasn't, or...?
Physically, and also his dedication.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if he stayed at West Point or not. So those were my two roommates in these barracks.
Were there other guys who were there at the time you were there who just simply couldn't cut it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At that first year, there was one guy. It was really amazing. In boxing class, they put you according to your weight. And there was one guy that I boxed that was the same weight as I was, only my arm length was bigger, and I could really beat him. And he left at Christmas. Then I got beat up a little more.
Uh-huh.
He's what I remember.
Okay.
And that's about all mm-hmm. I remember.
Okay. Tell me about the academics. How did that go for you?
That was pretty simple.
Was it really?
Yeah, because I'd already had most of that stuff in college. First year wasn't very difficult.
Now, is it the case, sir, that all of the West Point students are essentially taking the same program?
At that time, it was.
Okay,
yes.
And
I don't know if they do that now.
It was pretty heavy with the math.
Math in the first year, yeah.
Okay, and but you rolled through that pretty well.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem with that.
Okay, other guys not so much the case.
Well, some did and some didn't. They would put you in sections according to how well you did. The first section was the top 15 guys, and the second section was the next 15, and so on. So I was always in the second or third section.
Were there some standout guys in your year, as you remember?
Not as I remember, no. Nobody really stood out.
Okay.
The ones that I see now that made the Lieutenant General and Major General, nobody would have suspected it at the time.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's
I think we have two Lieutenant Generals in our class, and that's
interesting. And those two you just wouldn't have
figured
it.
No, wouldn't have expected them at all.
Hmm. You mentioned that your parents did come up that first Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
What did you do? Do you remember?
Well, you didn't go out very much.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember much about it except walking around with them and taking pictures.
Okay, but you were probably pretty clear they were proud of you.
Oh, yeah.
Did they come up again before graduation to visit you?
I don't think they did before graduation. They came up for graduation, of course.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I don't think they came up. My oldest brother was living in New York City at that time.
Uh-huh.
And they came up and stayed with him and all, but I don't... Then he moved to Asheville, too.
Okay.
after the war and after he got married.
Now, when did you graduate?
In 52.
Okay.
It was the sesquicentennial class. They had a big celebration. It was the 150th anniversary of the founding of West Point.
That must have been a big deal.
Oh, yeah. All the... professors of other units, all the presidents of the universities, all the defense attachés from Washington. President Truman came up, I remember, and gave a speech, and we were the sesquicentennial class.
Now,
on our class crest, it has a little CL under the equal.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And
that also, that meant that our 50th anniversary in 2002 was the 200th anniversary of the Military Academy.
Did you go back for that, sir?
Oh, yeah. We had our 50th reunion.
Oh, yeah. I bet you did. That must have been something as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, there were about 600 or 700 people there. Everybody brought their wives and their children and their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice.
did they put on a good party for you?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
We had a review in our honor, and the 50th anniversary is always a big deal.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, when you graduated then, was the graduation speech given by the president? Or was that speech at a different time?
I don't even remember. It was a different time. It was a little bit later.
Some very keen historian in the future can look that up.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's listed in our graduate records. They publish a book every year with all the graduates and the whole biography of everybody and when they lived and when they died and how old they were and all that. And
sure.
I think it's in there who spoke.
Now, did you hear the president speak? Were you actually there to hear
President
Sherman?
Oh, yeah, he was in the mess hall. We were all eating together.
Mm-hmm.
He made a speech.
Do you remember anything about what he said?
No. Very not.
Did you have an impression of him?
Well, he seemed to be very decisive and very proud, too. But I didn't get to see much of him except the speech.
Sure, sure. Of course, while you were there, the Korean conflict
started
and really ramped up and the United States commitment expanded.
Well, it was really funny because our class, we got to choose the branch we wanted to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't want to take, I found out at West Point that I was very good in social sciences, history, economics, government, and so on. I'd always been oriented toward engineering, and I didn't like, I found I wasn't all that good at engineering. I didn't like mechanics and science and all that kind of stuff. I liked the history and the softer subjects better.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to go into the infantry because I wanted to go to graduate school in one of the social sciences. And all the people that went into the engineers and Signal Corps and all that, they went to technical graduate school.
Yes.
And I didn't want to do that, so I went in the infantry so that I could go to a graduate school in social sciences.
And after your graduation, is that what happened? You went straight on?
Well, first of all, in my graduating class, you could choose to go to Korea or not to Korea. You couldn't choose Korea, but if you chose Germany, or if you chose one of the airborne divisions in the south, that meant you weren't going.
Okay.
And so I chose Fort Dix, New Jersey, which meant that that was a training division and that I was going to Korea.
Uh-huh.
So you went to the infantry school, you went to the parachute school, and then in about right before Christmas, I went to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And at that time, the Army had a rule that you had to have 90 days worth of troop duty before you go to Korea. So I got my orders to go to Korea within 90 days. I had 2 months of marching soldiers around and 30 days leaving. That was my 90 days, and I was off to Korea.
Okay. And when did you go over there, sir?
I think about April. March or April of, what year is that, 53. And I was assigned to the 38th Infantry, and I was an infantry rifle platoon leader.
Did you see actual combat deployment?
Oh, yeah.
Whereabouts?
Well, we were on the front lines. Where was it? Hill 605. Well, there was a big mountain there called Papasan 605. We were in Chorwan.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to some Korean girl, and she said, "Where are you stationed?" I said, "Chorwan." And she said, no, the Chinese are in Chorwan. And I said, yeah, that's right there in this part of Chorwan, and we're in the other part, and we're trying to get in their part, and they're trying to get in our part. And so there was Outpost Harry, and what else was the hook? We were on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And that was April, May, June, July, and then the war ended in July.
Yeah, that's right.
27th of July, 1953, which really made me mad because that meant that in Korea, you got 4 points a month or 3 points or 2 points. If you're in the rear, you got 2 points a month, and you had to get 36 points to rotate.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, where I was in combat, you got 4 points a month, so you could rotate in 9 months. But after the war was over, everybody, same thing 1 year tour. So I was there for a year.
You were there for until the next summer then?
Yeah.
Okay. Until the middle of 1954?
Yeah. I got promoted to first lieutenant army, and it was 18 months. But in Vietnam, if you had 12 months in grade and 2 months in country, you could do it. So I just squeezed in.
Yes.
The war ended on the 23rd of July, and my day of rank as first lieutenant was 2 August.
Well, sir, let me ask you about that that period when combat was still going on, and you were you had taken over the platoon, is that right?
Yeah.
What was the call number, call sign for the platoon?
Oh.
Do you remember?
Impel.
Okay.
Impel 1, I guess we were. Yeah.
And
it was 2nd Division, 38th Infantry,
second, A
Company.
Okay.
1st Platoon. That's always going to be mad because every time they wanted an attack or a patrol or something, they'd say, let 38th Infantry do it. And 38th Infantry would say, A Company, and A Company would say, 1st Platoon. And I'd say, oh, gosh, not again.
Not again, yeah. You guys were always the first ones.
Yeah.
Because you were the first, right?
Well, I told that to the battalion commander one time. Why don't you say B Company, 3rd Platoon, or C Company, 2nd Platoon?
Right.
And he said, no, it's not because you're the first platoon, it's because we know you'll get the job done.
Did you believe him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was pretty straight.
Well, tell me about this command experience that you had. This is the first time that you've had had men in charge under you?
Well, at first I became the P&A platoon leader, the Pioneer and Ammunition platoon leader. And they had not had a platoon leader for a long time, and they had a lot of Koreans, they call them Katusas, Korean augmentation to the United States Army.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a very good first sergeant, I guess a platoon sergeant, Sergeant Fajardo. I'll never forget him. He was everyone guy, and all he wanted was an officer to back him up, tell him he was doing good.
He had it in hand already.
Oh, yeah. He knew what he wanted to do.
Sure.
And so I helped him get that platoon in shape, and they got in good shape. And once they had an officer to speak for them, they weren't getting all the dirty jobs and all.
Now, what kind of stuff had they been being assigned to, these dirty jobs? I mean, what kind of things?
Cleaning up the motor pool, cleaning up the latrines, any job they needed done. And so I'd come in and say, no, they're not going to clean the motor pool. That's the motor pool's job. And that relieved them of that duty. And I made sure that other units of the headquarters company got their share of the dirty jobs. And we didn't do that anymore. We did our work, which was supplying the front lines with ammunition and doing whatever engineer work needed being done on the roads and so on.
Now, the work of supplying the front lines with ammunition, for example.
Yeah.
Colonel, how did that actually work? Did your guys have to pull things out of stores?
Oh, no, we had it all.
Okay.
There was an ammunition point near us, and we'd pull it out of there.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And take it up. We had a regular routine to do that. We supplied it on a routine basis. That was the easiest part of the job. The hardest part was little things that came up, like a culvert would wash out and wash the road out, and we'd have to get a lot of dirt and put it in there and put a new culvert in, things like that.
Okay, Did your men respond well then to to you coming in?
To me and Sergeant Fajardo, they sure did.
Okay.
Sergeant Fajardo had it all lined up. He knew what he wanted to do as long as I would back him up.
Now, did the guys come up with a nickname or anything like that for you?
No,
that you know about?
Not at that time.
Okay. Tell me about any...
I tell you one time,
sure.
The battalion commander called me in, and he said, Lieutenant Chandler, you're an enigma to me. I never forget this conversation. I said, yes, sir. And he said, I tell you what to do, how highway, what I want you to do, and all this, and you smile. And you say, yes, sir, and you salute, then you go back and do exactly what you were doing before.
And he called you an enigma.
Yeah.
And
because I knew what I was doing, and
yes.
I was doing okay.
Yes.
I need him to tell me.
You weren't in need of a lot of help either, really. That's what I'm picking up. Did your men ever did they come under fire at any time, sir?
Not in the PNX. No, they didn't. Not while I had them.
Okay.
And then I got transferred to A Company, 1st Platoon.
Okay.
And we came under fire then. About all we did was go out on patrols. The war was coming to an end. We didn't know that, of course.
Sure.
But we go on patrols at night and ambush patrols to ambush the Chinese, who are also on patrols.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all the combat you got was in the patrols. We attacked one hill, I think, one time, but I didn't lose any men. I lost some wounds.
Okay. Can you tell me, can you describe what those night patrols were like? Were there any one of them or a kind of composite description? Anything like that you could share with us?
Well, you usually went out after dark and found a place where you thought the Chinese would come. And then you would sit there, set up an ambush and sit there. And there was no smoking, no talking, no moving.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to sit there, and the Chinese would send their patrol out, and they'd have to sit there. And the first one that moved got shot, so we were very patient, and we waited for the Chinese to move, and then we'd mow them down.
Right.
So most of the time our patrols were very quiet and calm, and all the troops knew they had to stay quiet, couldn't smoke cigarettes, and we had a lot of patrols that were very successful.
Now, successful in terms of identifying a location of another of a Chinese patrol and taking
them
out?
Yeah, and wiping and attacking them when they moved.
Mm-hmm. And could you be sure, or how could you be sure, that you would get all of them?
Well, we never were sure you get all of them, but you get some of them, the rest of them run away.
Okay. After an incident of contact like that, would your men stay in the same position, or would
they? Oh, no. When we expose ourselves, then we'd go back.
Yes, sir.
And we'd have flares and light up the battlefield so we could see them, and they couldn't see us, or they didn't know it was coming. We were concealed. So we'd fire some flares, and then we got the hell out of there.
You'd skedaddle on out of there.
Yeah.
Okay. And were you and your men also trying to keep track of how many enemy you had?
Oh, yeah, eliminated? Yeah. We'd search the bodies if there were documents or anything on them.
Okay. And did that ever happen? Did you ever find any
no,
material?
No, any documents? No, I don't know. We'd send them back. They were all in Chinese.
Uh-huh. So you just send them back to Intel or somebody?
Yeah,
back
that's
there?
Right.
Okay. About how many of the patrols that your guys were on actually had contact? I mean, was it every night? Was it every fourth night? Or
no, every third night, I suppose, or fourth night.
Okay.
About four patrols that went on had contact. The rest didn't. I wasn't the only one doing this.
Sure.
There were other platoon leaders out there.
Yes, yes.
We had the Dutch battalion attached to our regiment, and they had patrols which were not as successful, of course, because they weren't. They were good soldiers, but they weren't as patient as we were.
Now, why was that?
I don't know. A lot of Indonesians in the Dutch battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And they would lose some people sometimes.
They just, was it that they didn't have the skill level or they weren't as stealthy?
They
or?
Didn't take it as seriously as we did, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
They were soldiers and they were out there and they did what they wanted to do.
And paid the price, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
Wow. Did the Dutch officers, I'm presuming that there were Dutch officers in charge, similarly take some hits because of their...
Yeah, I didn't know if there were many Dutch officers. I knew the P&A platoon leader, and the Dutch were apparently buying all that they had, they were paying for. And so when we ran out of things, we could always go to the Dutch and get it, like paint and things like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they well supplied. And we would always take rice over to them. A lot of them were Indonesians.
Right.
And they traded other things for our rice.
They wanted the rice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. What about other allies? Were there other?
We didn't see any. Just
allied
Dutch
units?
In our battalion.
Okay.
In our regiment.
In your regiment. Uh huh.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned
each
that
each regiment had three American battalions. And a foreign battalion. We had the Dutch. The next division over had the French. The next division over had the Ethiopians and so on.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's how they handled the command and control of the Allied units.
And to some degree also the integration.
Yeah, that's right.
You mentioned earlier that there was maybe one operation where you actually had to perform an assault of some kind on
the hill. Yeah.
Can you describe that?
Well, there was a little hill, and we had to take the little hill in that was in front of us, and the Chinese were on the far hill, and they came over and got on the little hill, and so we just ran up the hill and shot them off.
You just literally ran up the hill?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they were dug into the top of the hill.
Yes, sir.
Not very well, and we got them off.
How many casualties?
I had about 10 men wounded. I didn't have anybody killed.
Okay. When your platoon, your group actually got into the position where they could see the enemy emplacement, what kind of emplacement was it? You said it wasn't very
just
good.
Little dugouts that they had dug, little foxholes.
And that was it?
Yeah.
No other reinforcement or anything?
No. They hadn't planned it very well when we got up there. There were more of us than there were then.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That didn't happen all the time. So
no,
that was actually quite good.
Yeah.
What was your evaluation? And I know in the heat of the moment, this kind of reflection wasn't possible. But as you've thought back over it, I'm sure over the years, your evaluation of the Chinese as an enemy in a land war.
We found out they weren't very good. They were very persistent. There were a lot of them, but they weren't very good. They didn't seem to be as dedicated as we were, and that was strange because all of our people were draftees, of course.
Yes.
And even the officers had gone to college. Everybody got drafted or went to work, went in the Army as an officer. So, yeah, our people were much more dedicated. They wanted to get it over with.
And the Chinese less so?
Well, I don't know if they left, but they weren't very persistent. There were a lot of them, but they faded fast, I guess.
Okay. What about their tactics?
Well, the only thing we saw was there weren't much tactics then except the patrolling at night.
Yes.
They were on their hill, and we were on our hill most of the time. One time we tried to get on their hill and got it because they had taken over a sort of a neutral ground in between.
So
we didn't see much tactics. Their patrol tactics weren't as good as ours. Because, maybe this leadership, they didn't have as much patience as we did.
I see.
And they were noisier.
What about weapons?
Well, they had AK-47s. We didn't get into that very much.
Uh-huh.
We didn't like their weapons.
Okay. Were their weapons as good as what the Americans had?
Oh, well, no, I guess not. We had M1 rifles, and they were very accurate, and they had AK-47s. They weren't too accurate, but they spread out a lot of bullets, so we weren't too much worried about their weapons.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you have air support during any of these operations, especially
the
assault?
I don't think so.
Not really?
I never saw any. I never knew how to call anything.
Okay. Okay. And, of course, that is a huge difference with what happens
in Vietnam.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. Yes,
in Vietnam, because they hadn't performed very well in Korea, they were determined to perform well and justify their own independence, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention budgets and funding and all that.
Yeah, and all that. Well, I never saw an airplane in Korea.
No kidding. Oh, jeez.
Or know how to call one in.
We're switching tack a little bit. What did the men do during their downtime in Korea?
Well, basically, as far as I can remember, we trained.
No kidding.
Yeah. We trained, and I guess I don't really remember any downtime. We kind of relaxed.
Uh-huh. Now, when you heard about the successful conclusion of the peace talks, which have been going on and on for many, many months.
Yeah.
You were a little bit disappointed. Is that right? Is that fair?
No, I was happy.
You were happy about the peace?
Yeah. The Vietnamese, the Koreans would ask me, does that mean Cho Ching Go Somsan? That's what they called the Chinese show chink.
Uh-huh. And what was the response?
Yeah, no, they don't go home.
Right.
We just quit trying to make them go home.
Right. was there a sense of relief amongst your men?
Well, yeah, sure.
Uh-huh. That they were probably going to get out of there? Or?
Yeah, that they were going to get out of there alive.
Yes.
I guess so. We trained. I remember that Christmas, we were notified. I was headquarters company commander. Then I'd been A company commander, and then I was headquarters company commander. And I was notified at Christmas that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his party were going to have Christmas with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought this big tent in. They brought these space heaters in. And we had to paint everything. We had to paint the rocks white and the fire barrels red, and we didn't have any paint. They got some, and it was real discouraging to my men because this guy flew in and then flew out, and then they took all this good stuff away from us.
they cleaned it up and took it away real fast.
Yeah.
how long were the VIPs there?
Oh, about half an hour.
No kidding. Is that all?
Yeah, I remember some. Navy captain said, where's the enemy? And I said, see that range of hills up there? That's him. He said, oh, God, I didn't know we were that close. A lot of our men who had to paint the rocks and paint the barrels and all that weren't too pleased to have this guy come in and have services at our battalion, at our battalion.
Who was it, sir? Do you remember?
I think it was... what's that guy's name? Starts with Rayford.
Radford?
Radford, yeah.
Sure. Uh-huh. So he was there and gone.
Yeah. And he had boasted he had Christmas services with the troops at the front.
Uh-huh. yeah, in the briefest possible time.
Yeah, as far away as possible.
That's right. Well, were you sort of in the receiving line at all, or...
Well,
just kind of
way
observing.
Down the line somewhere, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. And how big was his entourage?
Oh, he had about 10, 12 people with him.
Okay.
One big helicopter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he was out of there.
Out of there, exactly.
Did you...
Captain enjoyed it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I'll bet. Did you have any other remembrances about that Christmas?
No, that's the only one.
Okay. You were in Korea, I think you mentioned, until the middle of 1954, is that right?
Yeah.
During that time period that you remained there, of course, there were big events brewing down in Indochina, particularly Dien Bien Phu. Do you remember any information coming to you about that?
The only thing I remember about that was when the war ended on the 23rd of July,
uh-huh.
On the 24th, we packed up all of our flak jackets that we didn't need anymore, and they told us they were going to drop into Dien Bien Phu.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And did they take them away from you?
Well, we didn't need them anymore. The war was over.
So did they actually come and pick them up? And
I guess so. We turned them in someplace, and they were gone.
Wow. That's
interesting. And we were told they were going to drop them into Dien Bien Phu.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a direct result, and after that, we didn't hear very much about it.
Okay. And you spent the rest of your time in Korea stationed where?
Well, with 38th Infantry, they made me, I was the headquarters company commander. Let me tell you, oranges were, fresh oranges were my worst problem. Soldiers would get an orange in the mess hall and come out and throw the orange peels down on the ground. And then somebody would have to pick them up, and they were very noticeable. And the tank commander would come out and holler for me and say, "Wow, these oranges!" So I never issued oranges again.
Well, you learned an important command lesson there.
That's right. A little prevention there.
That's right. And stand you in good stead for the rest of your career.
No oranges to be issued.
That's right. Yes, sir.
They could issue apples because the apple cores were biodegradable,
right.
I guess.
And not as visible.
Animals would eat them, but not orange fields.
Yes, sir. At what point did you find out what your next arrangement with the Army would be?
I don't know, sometime before I left.
Okay.
I was going to Fort Carson, Colorado to be a company commander. I was still a first lieutenant. at that time, after the war, they started to give credit to medical and dental officers for their education.
Yes.
And so they made all the doctors captains, and that meant that there were too many captains in the Army, and the first lieutenants in the regular Army got behind. And I say the first lieutenant for 59 months.
So essentially there was a kind of a bottleneck?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
And how long did that situation persist? I mean, I know it affected you for a while.
Well, quite a while. I was the first lieutenant for 59 months. It's about 5 years.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I commanded the company at Fort Carson for a year. I commanded the company in Korea for a year. I went 2 years of graduate school, and I taught at West Point for a year, and I was still a first lieutenant.
How frustrating was that for
you?
Yeah,
pretty frustrating.
Yes, sir, I imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And this was because of that rearrangement of the medical
Of the medical corps, right. And
okay.
Nobody changed the quotas. You know, you know how to have so many captains and so many majors.
Right.
They took up all the spaces.
And just overnight there were fleets of them.
Yeah.
Probably. Wow.
Yeah.
How long were you at Fort Carson then?
1 year.
Okay.
Because I was commanding a company there, and I was getting kind of tired of it.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, you had to have a 3-year commitment to the Army. And I wrote to West Point and said, you told me when I had from 4 to 6 year service to write, and maybe I could be an instructor, and I've only got 3 year service, so how about it? And West Point wrote me back and said, well, one guy that they had programmed had not panned out, and they couldn't use him, and they had a vacancy, and what college would I like to go to? I was still a first lieutenant. And I didn't know of any colleges, and I said, well, send me to Harvard. And they said, okay, and I got orders to Harvard.
And you spent how long there?
I was sent there for a year, and then another guy extended, and so I stayed there for 2 years.
And you earned a postgraduate degree?
I got my master's degree and everything for the PhD except a dissertation.
Okay, so you were ABD, as they
say.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay, what was the master's degree? What was the field?
Master in Public Administration.
Okay. Now, go ahead.
Harvard at that time, they give you an MPA from where you can use a year of government service and a year at Harvard, and you get your MPA.
Yeah. The public administration curriculum, can you tell me about what it was like then?
Well, we were taking, you could take anything you wanted basically from the School of Arts and Sciences, and since there were three of us, one from the class of 50 and one of my classmates there, and we were going for the PhD, so the PhD was a joint degree in politics and economics.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to take three fields of politics, three fields of economics. And you could write one field off in each by getting A minus or above. And then you had to recite on two fields
the other
each.
Two. Mm-hmm.
So we took those courses, and I found that I was pretty good in political science and history and things like that, and I'm in engineering. And at the end of the 2 years, you'd recite on your two fields in economics and two fields in politics. You'd have four fields to recite on. And whether you passed or not meant you were eligible to go on for your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
For your dissertation.
Now, that was your plan at some point?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you were thinking about teaching.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
West Point didn't care what you taught. They sent you up there to acquaint you with the field, I guess, and with graduate education.
Sure.
And so we took the fields we could write off and the fields we wanted to recite on, and we had a recitation at the end of the second year.
Now, would I be right in thinking that the years that you were there would be about 1955 to 56?
57, yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay. And yeah. See, I'm keeping track. And where were you living?
Well, I was a pastor then. I lived in an apartment in Cambridge.
Okay.
Near the university.
Okay.
The first year I lived with Jim Gerhardt, a classmate of mine, who was taking the same course. And the second year I decided to live alone in another apartment.
Also in Cambridge?
In Cambridge, right.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any military duties during this time period?
Oh, none at all.
So you were just a graduate student hanging out?
Graduate student, two best years of in the Army. Got $100 extra for buying books, and that's about all. And we went to summer school, too. We went 2 years and three summers.
Can you characterize that time period in your life? I mean, it sounds sort of like salad days to me. A very, very nice time.
It was delightful.
I'm sure.
All you had to do was go to school.
Yeah.
And study at night, of course, and take the exam. So, yeah, it was great compared to what I've been doing.
Yes, sir. and, of course, Cambridge is a very nice environment.
Nice social. And we had good professors, too. There were three professors there. They were assistant professors, and they were trying to make associate professor, and only one could make it. And their names were Samuel Huntington, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Stanley Hoffman.
Are you kidding me?
No, we had them all three. Stanley Hoffman was my thesis advisor, and Graham Allison was my second reader. And the university chose Stanley Hoffman. And Brzezinski and Huntington went to Columbia. And then the next year, they chose Huntington. He came back, and Brzezinski stayed at Columbia. So my orals board had, Brzezinski was on it. And Baldwin, who was another up-and-coming economist, and Professor Gershon Krohn, and I was fortunate with Dan Cheever, who was an old friend.
Well, obviously, for anyone who studied international relations, which includes myself, these are some of the biggest names in the secondary literature now. You still have to read Huntington if you want to know about social change. Yes.
Yeah, that was his dissertation.
That's just an astounding set of opportunities. Were they brilliant? I mean, can you remember them as...
Oh, yeah. Huntington's very good, very hard to understand. And Brzezinski was very sharp and very encouraging. Oh, yeah, that, I remember him well. I'm still friends with him. They know me when they see me. Because I did my dissertation under Huntington.
And what was the topic that you worked on?
Well, that it took me 15 years, and we'll get to that later.
Okay, well, I'll make
that
sure.
Was about Vietnam.
Okay, I'm going to make a note. And that would be that probably led then to the publication of your first book, is that right?
My first book was my dissertation.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to clarify, and I'll come back to those issues.
Okay, excuse me. Sharon? Are we doing anything tomorrow afternoon? Boasting was teaching at West Point, of course.
Okay, and you were there for 1 year, is that right?
3 years.
Oh, 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Tell me about going back.
Well, I liked it. I enjoyed it very much. I was still a first lieutenant.
I know. That's a little hard to take.
Yeah.
You must have had some faith, though, that this situation was going to work itself out.
Yeah, well, we had a good department. I was teaching government, comparative government, European government. I taught American history. And the cadets were great, and football games were great, and teaching went hard.
Now, tell me how the football team was doing in those years.
Oh, they were doing great. We had Pete Dawkins and Carpenter, the Lonely End. We were undefeated. We were number one in the country. We beat Navy every year. Best game I ever saw was we beat Navy 38-0 one year.
And that was one of the years that you were teaching there?
Yeah.
So, like, about 59, maybe?
They must have been somewhere around there, yeah.
Okay. So that stands out in your mind.
Oh, yeah.
Was that at home?
They always played in Philadelphia.
Can you evaluate the students that you had in the
classes? Well, the students were put in sections according to their class standing. And I always liked to teach. Then nobody up at West Point was dumb.
That's right.
They were all good students. Some were slower than the others. That's the only difference. And we went fast.
And you put them through paces, is that is that fair?
And so I always seemed to teach the upper sections because they were better. And I could go beyond the lesson with them.
Were you thinking about future on the faculty there?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I probably could have, but I didn't want to do that. I'd go down to New York every weekend. I had a couple of friends from high school who were hot shots in the advertising business in New York, and I'd see them, but I didn't want to stay up at West Point for the rest of my life.
Because why?
Well, I thought it was kind of dead. You know, you were out of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do something else. I knew I was scheduled to go overseas when West Point was done. I wanted to go to Germany and see the sights.
Colonel, is that what happened?
Yeah, what happened, really? I was assigned to Germany. And one of the professors at West Point, who sat right behind me, was with the 10th Special Forces Group. And he said, get him. So, well, let's see what happened. Before I was assigned to Germany, and I told the assignment officers who came down from Washington to sign us off, that from West Point, I went to the advanced course at Fort Benning. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
West Point, I went to the advanced infantry officers course at Fort Benning. And then they came down from Washington to tell us our assignment, and they said, you're going to Germany. And I said, all right, I figured I was. But I said, emergency request. I'd like to, my parents' 50th anniversary is going to be on the 4th of August. And here it is June. And so I would like to go to some school in the United States for 6 weeks because we're going to have a family reunion. Then if I were in Germany, I'd have to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to go to some school for 6 weeks, and then I'll happily go to Germany after the anniversary.
Sure.
And they said, well, that sounds reasonable enough. And they looked through it, and they said, well, the only school we have starting at that time is the Special Forces Officers Course at Fort Bragg. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to learn more about that, but I don't want to get into it. And they said, well, don't worry about that. It's a bunch of old airborne guys, close society and all that. And I said, okay, send me this to the Special Forces School. Then one of my professors at West Point was in the 10th Special, one of the guys I work with, but who was a year ahead of me, was in the 10th Special Forces Group. And he saw my name on the list and said, okay, we got to get him. And so I was assigned to the 10th Special Forces Group. And then he wrote me and said, they're starting, after you finish the Special Forces Officer School, they're starting a new counterinsurgency course, so I want you to stay and take that. Well, that course didn't begin until 6 weeks after the Special Forces School. And so I went to Special Forces School, and then I was on the faculty for 6 weeks preparing the counterinsurgency course, and then I was a student in the counterinsurgency course except for those lessons that I was teaching, and then I finally got to Germany about December.
And so you helped design that first CI
counterinsurgency course?
Counterinsurgency
course at Fort Benning, yeah.
Okay, wow.
Was it Fort Benning or Fort Bragg? Fort Bragg.
At Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break there.